Rabbi Beryl Wine's series of lectures on Jewish history and much more are the basic programming element of JM and the AM during the 9 days. Been like that for a long time, and we are now proud to present from the series entitled Builders of the Holy Land, Rabbi Beryl Wine's lecture on Rabbi Shmuel Salant here at JM in the AM.
Tonight's lecture concerns itself with one of the most fascinating personalities of the 19th and early 20th centuries, but a person who's very little known in the modern Jewish world, and that's Rabbi Shmuel Salant. Rabbi Shmuel Salant was the rabbi of Jerusalem for 70 years, from 1839 to 1909. He died, he was in his 90s when he died. And he is a person that had a tremendous influence on the land of Israel and on the Jewish people generally. And he was a very fascinating personality. Anybody that can survive 70 years as being a rabbi, for that alone deserves a lecture. And anybody that can survive 70 years being the rabbi in Jerusalem deserves a double lecture. So we're going to have two lectures on Rabbi Salant. He was born in 1816 in a small village, Vilkinik, near Bialystok. And his father was a well-known rabbi, but his father died when he was a very young child, 6 or 7. And therefore he was really raised without parents. And in general we'll see that his life had a great deal of shadow to it. It certainly wasn't easy. Now, I've discussed with you that some of the personages that we have discussed here are people who had enormously gifted minds and at an early age their genius appeared. Others didn't develop till later. He was, however, such a genius that by the time he was 4 years old, he was well known already for Talmudic erudition at the age of four. He was a raving genius. I mean, there was nobody that was his equal in those terms. But again, it'll be fascinating to know that his reputation was not made in scholarship as much as it was made in communal leadership. He was, as I mentioned, he became orphaned when he was very young, and there was nobody to take care of him. So there was a custom among Jews in Eastern Europe and Lithuania that homeless children or orphaned children or children that had no one to take care of them automatically became the ward of the rabbi. And if the child was gifted, so then they sent him to great rabbis. And that it was a compact, so to speak, something. It was understood that the rabbi would take him in and help raise him. Again, in our society, it's hard to imagine that type of situation, but it was very common in Eastern Europe in the 19th century. And since in the 19th century, Jewish life in Eastern Europe was very, very depressing. It was very sad. Epidemics, malnutrition, pogroms, life expectancy was, Jewish life expectancy was in the 40s. So because of all of that, one can imagine that these cases were not rare. When he was 7, he came to Vilna. And in Vilna there was a famous rabbi, Rabbi Avalev Pasveler, he was known. He was one of the great geniuses, a Talmud of the Gaon of Vilna, colleague of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, one of the great Lithuanian figures of his time. And he took care of this young child, even though Reb Avalev himself was in advanced years. He was in his 80s. He was taking care of a 7-year-old child. That's not something that is easy to do. Children, God ordained that children should be taken care of people when they're still young. when people become older, it's much harder to deal with children. It requires an element not just of patience, but even of physical strength that is not, that's not present any longer. I remember that I was once in the house of a famous Rosh Yeshiva who had married a woman that was much, much younger than he was, almost 30 years younger than he was. And he was, when I was there, he was already in his 60s, and they had the 3 or 4 year old son. And I was in the study talking with the Rosh Yeshiva, and the kid came in bouncing a ball, you know, and bounced the ball all over the room and everything. And he looked at me like he said, you know, like, what am I supposed to do about this now, right? I'm 65 years old. What am I supposed to do about it? Well, there's a remarkable vignette here that for 2 years he was raised in the house of Avila Pasviller, who studied with him. And Reb Shmuel Salant said in later years, when he was asked to what he attributed his great longevity to live well into the 90s, so he said because Reb Avila gave him a blessing. Reb Avila blessed him that he would live a long time. And there's the legend about it is that Reb Avila blessed him if the kid wouldn't annoy him. He told, you know, I mean, that's the other side of the coin, right? That if he'd, because he was a genius, and geniuses have within themselves a certain amount of mischievousness that goes hand in hand. After 2 years, he moved to the city of Kaidan. Kaidan was also one of these famous little villages, cities in Lithuania that had a tradition of great rabbis, great rabbinic scholars. And therefore the city, even though it was small in number and poor in economy, and there wasn't any reason inherent that the city should have greatness to it, but it was well known because of the fact that it had over the centuries a string of very famous rabbinic figures who had served as rabbi in that town. When he came there in the year 1825, so the rabbi of Kaidan was Rabbi Avraham Shimon Traub, who was also a colleague and a student of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. And the Volozhiner yeshiva had just then opened, and Reb Chaim Volozhiner, who was the main disciple of the Gaon of Vilna, had a cadre of students that were rabbis in Lithuania who helped him in the founding of the yeshiva in Volozhin. And Rabbi Avraham Shimon Traub was one of them. He stayed in Kaidan for approximately 6 years. And when he was 14, he married, and he married the daughter of the rabbi of Kaidan. Now, marrying at 14 was accepted practice in Jewish Lithuania in the early 19th century. And then the Tzim of Volozhin married at 14. It was a combination of many things, a very short life expectancy, maturing very early, combination of a lot of, and the social climate. And in the non-Jewish world also, early marriages were extremely common in the Polish and Lithuanian peasantry. Later on in the yeshiva world, in the late 1800s and in the 1900s, yeshiva students got married late because of the fact that they wanted to continue their studies, etc., so the age was postponed till the late 20s or sometimes even early 30s. But at this period of time, almost universally in the Jewish world, certainly in the Hasidic world, and even in the world of Lithuanian Jewry, marriages were in the adolescent years. So he became the son-in-law of the rabbi of Kaidan, and it was like accepted that he would eventually become the rabbi of Kaidan because he was the rabbi's son-in-law and he was one of the great geniuses. He was an Ilui. And so in the natural course of events, he would become the rabbi. However, the marriage was a very unhappy marriage. And after a number of years, he divorced his wife. They just could not. They could not come to any modus vivendi in their home. And he divorced his wife, so he had to leave Kaidan, and he moved to the village of Salant, where he acquires this last name, Rabbi Shmuel Salant. In Lithuania, at least, it was very common to be called on the name of the town. There were no last names per se in the Jewish world yet, and the Tsar would not order the Jews to have last names for another 40 years. And therefore, the name Salant only meant that he came from this village of Salant. Now, Salant was, again, one of these villages that God created. It's one of the most famous names in the Jewish world today, because of three people who came, who lived in Salant at the same time, and whose lives were inextricably bound one to another. First, and I'll talk, God willing, about all three of them, Rabbi Zundel of Salant, Rabbi Yisrael Salant, and Rabbi Shmuel Salant. And because of that, they are the ones that made the village immortal, even though the village itself is, in Yiddish, they used to say, as big as a yawn, right? That has no, that has nothing to recommend it as being a place of importance. In Salant, the rabbi of Salant was a man called Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Broide. And Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Broide, his nickname was Reb Hirschel Tosfos, because he used to study Tosfos. He had the analytic ability to take the most difficult sections of the Talmud and of the commentaries of the Talmud and analyze it, break it down to the end, so that one saw the entire, all the fibers that went to make the entire cloth. And this analytic method would become very popular later. It became the method in the Lithuanian yeshivas. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik would popularize it in Volozhin. So he was like the forerunner of it. He was like the pioneer. Even though, in essence, if we look back at it, this really was the method of study of the Gaon of Vilna, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, etc., of intensive analytic study that delved into the matter itself and removed all extraneous comparisons. I don't want to be misunderstood, but if the problem with pilpul is that you don't see the trees for the forest, and the problem, right, you don't see the individual case because you got the whole forest that's just flying about you. And they went to the other extreme, that there was no forest, there was only the tree. Naturally, as in everything else, there is a happy medium somewhere. But he was a very, very famous Rav, and a brilliant young men came to study. He didn't have a yeshiva per se, but they came to study with him, and he always had a cadre of 10, 15, 20 young men who came to study with him. So after his divorce, Rabbi Shmuel left Kaidan and he went to Salant in order to study with Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Broide. And Tzvi Hirsch Broide said that he had a seven-tiered candelabra. He had seven great students. So the three that I mentioned, Reb Zundel, Reb Yisrael, and Reb Shmuel Salant, were three. Reb Itzel Aponovizher was four. And Reb Alexander Meisha Lapidus, who later was the Rav in Raisan, was five. He had seven great students. And they were all there at one time. So it was, in modern-day terminology, we would say it was probably the greatest think tank that Lithuanian Jewry had in Torah in one place at one time. And they all were geniuses, and they all had tremendous ability to study. So they made a compact. They studied 20 out of 24 hours. And Reb Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement, and Reb Shmuel of Salant were chevrusas. They learned together. They were the pair that learned together. And Reb Zundel, who was older than they were, was like, well, what shall I say? He was the mashgiach. He influenced them. He was like their mentor. They were younger, and he was their mentor. Reb Zundel was a person that was a businessman. He had a small business, but his business was not business. His business was Torah. His business, Reb Yisrael Salanter described him as a ladder whose base is on earth and whose heaven and whose head reaches the heavens. So that even though it looked like he was in business, he really was in God's business. And he was the strongest single influence on both of them, on Reb Yisrael Salanter, because he is the one that encouraged Reb Yisrael Salanter in the study of Musar and later in the development of the Musar movement. And he was the strongest influence on Reb Shmuel Salant, because we will see that he became his father-in-law. That Reb Shmuel Salant married Reb Zundel's daughter. And poverty in the house was not to be believed. I'm getting ahead of the story, but the vignette is important. Montefiore became a very good friend of Rabbi Shmuel Salant. So Montefiore, who came in a golden carriage and white horses, and who lived in Forche, and so when he came to see Rabbi Shmuel Salant in Yerushalayim, so Rabbi Shmuel Salant lived in the courtyard right next to the Churve Shul, you know, today where the great arch is. They're going to rebuild that shul someday. And he lived in one of the hovels, the basements underneath, that there was no window in the house. There was no window in the house. We're not talking about heat or running water. There was no window in the house. And he lived in a two-room hovel, and he had the boxes for furniture. So Montefiore once said to him, "Doesn't your wife complain?" And Reb Shmuel, who had a very good sense of humor, said, "It's better than what her father had." Right? Like, I uplifted her standard of living. Because Reb Zundel and Salant had even less, if that's imaginable. And to a certain extent, their poverty was a badge of honor to them, because if a person really can do it, then one needs nothing from the world. Then one can look away from the world. In our time, it's very difficult even to speak in those terms. But they were able to live in those terms. It really, that was not their problem in life. Now, his father-in-law left Salant in 1837 to go to Israel, to go to Jerusalem. He moved to Jerusalem. His father-in-law moved when he was 58 years old, and his father-in-law said that he has years left, and that he knows that in heaven they promised him 30 years in Jerusalem. So he's got to go now, because he said to go to Jerusalem just to be an old person and not be able to do anything. So he went. You're talking about 1837. It was not an easy trip. You didn't get on an El Al plane, and you're not there in 10.5 hours, and they don't show you any movies, and they don't give you any food to eat, and the whole thing is just, it was months, and it was danger. But he went, and he established himself in Jerusalem. When he established himself in Jerusalem, he wrote home to his son-in-law and said that you should also come. He wrote him that the holiness of Jerusalem, the atmosphere of Jerusalem, is such that one's spiritual development is so enhanced that why should he waste himself in the exile? So he said it as a matter of his own experience. So Jerusalem and the land of Israel is, like many other things, it's a litmus test of the person. The greater the person, the more he feels in Jerusalem. The greater the person, the more he feels in the land of Israel. The lesser the person, so, you know, then it's like Buenos Aires, or it isn't like Buenos Aires, even. But there's nothing to do in town. And the person of Reb Zundel's stature, a person of Reb Zundel's character, so he came to Jerusalem, so he wrote to his son-in-law, he said, like, this is, you know, this is the Garden of Eden, this is paradise. And God, so to speak, is palpable here, you can touch it. Florida would say, come on down, right? That's what he told him to do. But, as all sons-in-law, Shmuel was not anxious to follow his father's advice father-in-law's advice initially. And instead, in 1837, he went to the yeshiva in Valozhin. He left Salant, and he went to the great yeshiva in Valozhin, and there he was not treated as a student, but he was treated as a member of the faculty, even though he still was a very young man. He was only 21 years old. But his fame as a scholar and his erudition and his good name had gone before him to such an extent that he was treated as a member of the faculty rather than as a student in the yeshiva.
JM and the AM, Rabbi Shmuel Salant, is Rabbi Beryl Wein's focus this morning during our history lecture here in our 9 days format. Just reminding everybody, at the top of the hour, 3 minutes from now, we'll join the OU in Israel and participate in the Tehillim rally, the Tehillim session on behalf of our brothers and sisters in Israel, which will take place at the OU Center. The gathering is being coordinated by the OU, the Rabbinical Council, Yeshiva University, and the National Council of Young Israel. We're proud to be a part of it. We'll join it live coming up at JM and the AM.
He stayed there for 2 years. He perhaps would have stayed the balance of his life, and if he would have stayed there, he would have undoubtedly had an educational position in Valozhin because of his greatness. But as in all matters, God interferes. God pushes us. And in 1838, he developed a very bad asthma and a touch of tuberculosis. So he went, the doctor told him that he has to go to a warmer climate, that Lithuania would be fatal for him if he stayed in Lithuania. And then the recipe and the prescription in Europe was to go to either Spain or Italy. So Reb Shmuel said, I should go to Spain or Italy. If I have to go to a warmer climate, I'm going to Israel. I'm going to go to Jerusalem. He remembered the letter that his father-in-law sent him. He and his wife then had a 2-year-old son, their first child. So upon consultation with her, they agreed that they would leave Lithuania and move to Jerusalem, move to Jerusalem. It's interesting, the doctor, he himself records it, that the doctor told him that even if he went to Italy, he probably would have no more than 5 to 10 years to live. And he lived 70 years more. So I knew a Jew in Miami Beach. That's a digression, but it's an important story. It's one of the things I remember. I knew a Jew in Miami Beach that when he was 37 years old, had 2 heart attacks and a major surgery, major operation for cancer. And the doctors told him that he probably would not live more than 2 years. And he was a very wealthy man. So he decided that he would move to Florida. And he cashed in all of his assets. And he bought an annuity policy. And the annuity policy promised to pay him for 55 years. And he outlived. He outlived it. I knew it at the end. I'll tell you a remarkable, tell you even a more remarkable story. So he had a big annuity policy, and he was a tremendous Balzdoker, and he had given the Ponovizhia Rav a great deal of money, always over the years. So when he was 92 or 93, so the policy stopped paying, and he was absolutely, except for his Social Security check, he was absolutely destitute. And the Ponovizhia Rav sent him money every month. The Ponovich Yarov sent him money every month to support it. But he always used to tell me, he says, you know, the doctor, he said, if I would have known, he said, I would have bought the annuity for 60 years. I'd only bought it for 55. But life is strange. It's never the way we think it is. So he went to Jerusalem. He took his wife and his son, and he went to Jerusalem. And he arrived there in 1840. On the way to Jerusalem, he went through Damascus. He went through Damascus. What they did is they went south through Russia. They went overland. They went through Turkey, and they went through Syria. It was all part of the... Syria then was not an independent country. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. It was all under Turkey. So he went to the Jewish community in Damascus. So he was Hoshina Rabbah at night. He was in the sukkah of the Chacham, of the Sephardic chief rabbi in Damascus, in the sukkah. The night of Hoshina Rabbah. That night, Montefiore, Sir Moses Montefiore, was also in Damascus, because that was the year of the Damascus blood libel. It was a famous, terrible blood libel in which a Capuchin priest and his helper were found murdered. And the priest's associates accused the Jews of murdering them in order to take their blood to bake matzahs. And the French consul general in Syria, in Damascus, confirmed it, that that's what happened. And the Ottoman Turks arrested five or six of the Jewish leaders of Damascus, and under indescribable torture, extracted confessions that Jews used blood for Passover, and that that's probably what happened, that these people were killed. And they did so, Nevach, they confessed because of the torture that they were subjected to. Montefiore traveled from London to Damascus to defend the matter and to release the prisoners. And he went to the Sultan of Turkey. He had the protection of Queen Victoria and of Lord Palmerston and of others and of the British Empire. And therefore he was a personage to be reckoned with. And he was able to successfully defend the Jews from regarding that blood libel. In fact, the Sultan then issued an official order that never again in the Turkish Empire would such a thing be allowed, such a blood libel, and anyone that says that about Jews will automatically be punished. And he obtained the release of those people. So Montefiore was there in Damascus at the same time that Rabbi Shmuel Salant was in Damascus. And they met in the sukkah, the night of Hoshina Rabbah, in the sukkah of the chief rabbi of Damascus. Now, Montefiore was a very great Jew, but he was a completely unlettered, simple Jew in terms of Jewish knowledge. He didn't know the difference between something that was a commandment from the Torah, what was a custom, etc. So he knew from his youth that there was a custom that on the night of Hoshina Rabbah, certain Jews stayed up all night. He was exhausted. He was exhausted from his efforts, etc. He came to the sukkah, and he felt his exhaustion overwhelming him. Nevertheless, he thought that staying up the night of Hoshina Rabbah is equal to blowing shofar, or having an esrog, or eating in the sukkah, whatever. So he asked the chief rabbi what he should do. So the chief rabbi of Damascus, the Sephardic chief rabbi, he said, well, you're from Europe, ask the European rabbi. So he asked Reb Shmuel Salant, and Reb Shmuel Salant naturally found a way, most rabbis find a way to put people asleep, and they found a way that he would be able to sleep, and he was appreciative of it, and they became friends. And we'll see that from this chance meeting, many great things happened. Again, as how God does things, the development of the Jewish city of Jerusalem is based on this chance meeting in the sukkah, the night of Hoshina Rabbah in Damascus in 1840. When he finally arrived in Jerusalem, what he did is they went overland to Beirut.
We'll close out our program today with more from Rabbi Beryl Wine on the life of Rabbi Shmuel Salant. This comes from the series entitled Builders of the Holy Land. Rabbi Wine's lectures, 1-800-499-WEIN or rabbiwine.com, rabbiwein.com.
And he found an Ashkenazi community there that numbered 500 people. The Ashkenazi community, whereas the Sephardi community was close to 8,000. And the Ashkenazi community was sadly discriminated against by the Sephardim and by the Arabs. I'll just give you one example. It would not be until 1875 that the Ashkenazi community would have permission to have its own shechita, to have its own abattoir to kill animals. And the reason for that was because the Muslims, they don't eat kosher, but the Muslims will not eat meat that is slaughtered by an infidel. Muslims, first of all, only eat from kosher animals. They only eat beef and lamb and goats. And they don't eat pork or any of the other things. And they also will not eat meat that is slaughtered by an infidel. A Christian is an infidel. Their definition of infidel was that anybody that is not from the Levant is an infidel. Anybody that's European. And therefore the Ashkenazi Jews were infidels. And that being the case, therefore, they would not give them permission to slaughter. And it took over 30 years of lobbying and of bribes and of all sorts of machinations until finally in the middle 1870s the Ashkenazi Jews received permission to have their own shechita, to have their own abattoir. Because there are differences in the shechita and in the laws and the ritual between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. Today in Israel there's pretty much a unified shechita which meets the requirements of all. But at that time that was not there yet. Now the Arabs, when they allowed the shechita to occur, so the Arabs did something which is have to understand what it was for Jews to live under the Arabs. We, especially we who come from Eastern European background, so we have no appreciation of the discrimination, of the hatred, of the humiliation which was part of the everyday life of Jews in Arab countries. So when they allowed the Jews to have, the Ashkenazim to have their own shechita, they required that before the blessing is made on the shechita, and before Yeshech, so you have to make a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem lakeinu melech olam asher kidshonu mitzvotav v'tzivonu al ha-shechita. Before they made the bracha, the sheikh had to say out loud, Basham Allah Arachman Arachim, which means, in the name of the great and holy Allah. Otherwise he couldn't shecht. So there were all types of shilas, whether that was permitted. And then the rabbis decided it was permitted. Then the Arabs wanted that it should be said not before the Jew makes the bracha, but before the Jew shechts, so that it would now be an interruption between the bracha of the Jew and the actual shechita. So the Jews always paid bribes to be able to say it before. And we're talking here the 1870s. We're talking 100 years ago. We're not talking Middle Ages. So the situation with the Muslim rulers, with the Arabs generally, has always been a very, very difficult one, to put it mildly. So when he came to Yerushalayim, the Sephardim were in control of the Jewish community. The Sephardim had an official rabbi who was called the Chacham Bashi. The Chacham Bashi was an official rabbi who represented the Jewish community to the Turkish authorities. It's the forerunner of the chief rabbi. The Sfardim always had a chief rabbi. Rabbi Cook in the 1920s will introduce the concept of an Ashkenazic chief rabbi. After the Turks, they changed the name of the chief rabbi to Sfardim from Chacham Bashi, which was the Turkish name, to Rishon Lezion, which is the Hebrew name, the first of Zion, meaning the Sephardic chief rabbi, and that's what he's known as today. When he came to Yerushalayim, so they moved in next door to his father-in-law, to Reb Zundel. So I've described to you the palace that he moved into. With two rooms. You can see it today, by the way. It's in the Chotzer. It's on exhibit. You go all the way down. I mean, I'm personally fascinated by it because my grandfather was yet on the Beis Din of Reb Shmuel Salant in Jerusalem at the turn of the century. And my mother, Aleha Shalom, was born in the old city in Bote Machse. So when I grew up, I always heard in the house, they always spoke about Reb Shmuel Salant like he was, you know, a member of the family, somebody that they had known. So, Reb Shmuel Salant had undertaken, he together with Reb Yisrael Salanter had undertaken a vow never to hold an official rabbinic position. When he came to Jerusalem, so they came to him and they said, you're the man. A, you're young. B, you're the greatest scholar. C, you have the organizational ability. And if we don't have a great rabbi, the Ashkenazi community will just deteriorate. It will disappear. So you have to do it. So he made a compromise. He never called himself the rabbi of Jerusalem. But he said he was a more horoa. A more horoa means that he answered shyless. He answered questions. Anybody that had a question in halacha, they came to Reb Shmuel Salant. So he was like the head of the Beth Din. But he never claimed to be the rabbi. And we'll see during his 70-year reign, he imported many great, four times, he imported great scholars and rabbis from Europe to serve as the official rabbi of Jerusalem. But as long as Reb Shmuel Salant was there in the community, even if one had the title of being the official rabbi, no one held him to be the official rabbi over Reb Shmuel Salant because of Reb Shmuel Salant's erudition and of his greatness, etc. This Churve Shul, that's called the Churve Reb Yudah HaChosid. The Churve, it was called the Churve because it was destroyed. The Arabs had destroyed it. The Arabs have an old history of destroying synagogues. And he was determined to rebuild it. Now, when he came in 1840, so by 1843 they had plans to rebuild. They were only missing the money, which in Jewish life is always this present, but that's not the main matter. But what happened was that a great dispute broke out now, which is par for the course in Jerusalem, because the poor people said, if you go on a building fund drive, then nobody's going to have money for us. Because the money that comes from Chutzlars, the money that comes from Europe, is going to be spent on this building, it's going to be spent on the synagogue, and that's the money that we live from. So there was a bitter battle, a bitter dispute. And here was one, here it is really on this issue that Shmuel Salant, so to speak, cut his teeth. That his leadership became accepted by all. Because he said that he undertook that there would be no diminution in the funds for the poor, and that there would be money to rebuild the building. And in 1848, he left Jerusalem to go on a fundraising drive in Europe, which again, it was unheard of. There had always been fundraisers who left to raise money, but that the chief of the community should leave to raise money, that was unheard of. But because of the fact that he made this commitment, so he felt that it was incumbent upon him to leave. So in 1848, he left Jerusalem, And he traveled through to Russia, Germany, Holland, and England. And in England, his friend Montefiore made him a parlor meeting. I mean, just show you that the world has not changed in 140 years. He helped him raise a substantial amount of money. He was a brother-in-law. Montefiore was a brother-in-law of Lord Nathan Rothschild. The Rothschilds gave him a large donation. And when he returned in triumph, because he had raised sufficient funds to rebuild the synagogue, plus he had more money for the poor than ever was had before. That itself enhanced his position in the community. In Yiddish, there's a phrase, der was hot de meia hot de deia. The one that has the 100 is the one that has the influence also. The one that raises the money, the one that that shows his ability to be able to finance the project, so he naturally has the most to say about the project. People listen to it. Now, he had founded in 1846 a small, when he came, there was no school for the Ashkenazic children to learn. They either went to the Sephardic or they learned at home. He founded a school, an elementary school called Yeshivas Eitz Chaim, which is the oldest yeshiva in Jerusalem today. And this school was right next door to the shul in the churve. So Yeshivas Eitz Chaim, he lived in the basement, and Yeshivas Eitz Chaim was like the top floor of that house. And next door was the shul. And again, in order to support the yeshiva, that was also part of his fundraising venture. In 1850, by 1850, in other words, 4 years after the yeshiva began, he was so successful that it now had 300 students, and he was able to raise the level, so it became a yeshiva gedola as well.
JM in the AM on the life of Rabbi Shmuel Salant. That's, of course, our Beryl Wine in this series on the Builders of the Holy Land, 9 days format here at JM in the AM.